Hello, and thank you for downloading this Conversations podcast. If you don't already subscribe, you can do it completely free of charge. It's easy. Details are on our website, abc.net.au/conversations, or just look for Conversations with Richard Feidler through iTunes.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations. January 4th, in the year of 1951, was a day full of dangerous signs. The army of Kim Jong-il swept across the border into South Korea, thereby starting the Korean War. In the bleak bush capital of Canberra, Prime Minister Robert Menzies contemplated an early election. And in a little hospital in Mount Gambier, South Australia, the heavens opened and with a thunderclap, Ian Cameron was born into this world. Ian Cameron is one of the most popular broadcasters in radio anywhere in Australia. He's been broadcasting to listeners in Perth for more than three decades. In and around that, Ian Cameron has been a farm labourer, a failed used car salesman, a roustabout, and despite his profanity, he's actually served two terms in federal parliament as the Liberal member for Stirling. Some years ago, Ian Cameron wrote his memoirs in two volumes. The first of these was called Rolling Into the World, and it was an affectionate recreation of growing up in country Australia in the 50s and 60s. And within that book, in just two pages, Ian related a deeply traumatic incident from his childhood. And it was the explanation for why Ian, who'd been a bright kid with high marks, why he dropped out of school before his 15th birthday. I recorded this conversation with Ian Cameron in front of a live audience at ABC Studios in Perth over the weekend. Ian, one thing I notice in interviewing other people who normally do interviews on ABC Radio is they're very comfortable being the interviewer but not the subject.
No.
What have you brought with you today to help you get through this?
I've got some champagne, but unfortunately it's not doing any good so far.
In your first volume of your memoirs, there's a lot of focus was put on that traumatic incident I mentioned in my introduction for you. But really, so much of it is such a heartfelt and beautiful memorial to the times that you grew up in.
Oh, look, growing up in those years, especially when you look back on them, you realise how lucky we were. You know, especially now with the way kids are so cocooned, and we were pretty much free-range kids in those days. And it was being part of a big family, second eldest of 10, it was a lot of fun.
Your mum wanted a daughter, though, when you arrived. You were the second oldest, weren't you? She wanted a daughter.
Yeah, she didn't speak to me, apparently, for quite a period of time. This is true, you know. And I said, well, thank you for telling me this in more recent years. This has traumatised me further. But didn't want a boy at that stage. She'd had Peter already. Then she had me. Then she had Charles. Then she had Malcolm. Then she had Bernadette, Josephine, Gerard, Mary, Murray and Imelda, in that order. And she can be a little bit on the tut-tut side. And I said, excuse me, where do those 10 kids come from? Stop your nonsense.
You grew up in the days of Amskol ice creams, Jaffa's, Kelvinator fridges, Kiora cordial, and there was a Vanguard Space Master in the driveway. I'm a different generation here, but I remember the jingles of the 1970s extremely well. They're sort of tattooed onto my mind. Is it the same for you for the 50s and 60s?
Oh, yeah. Especially when television came along at the Melbourne Olympics, and we got television fairly fast after that, because Dad was doing okay at the time with the timber mill that he had, but we used to listen to the radio a lot. That's where I got the love of radio from. I used to listen to the Advertiser Broadcasting Network in South Australia. That was 5AD Adelaide, 5PI Central, 5MU Eastern, and 5SE, Southeastern South Australia. 5SE was the Mount Gambier station. But you'd hear the commercials on that. Tarax soft drinks. Do you recall Tarax?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I do.
That was Tarax, can. Tarax is in cans for you. Tarax, can. Tarax, that's enough for two. And there was Brill Cream, a little dabble, do you? I went off that, though, because every Sunday before Mass, Dad would do the Brill Cream thing, and he'd sing it in the bathroom as he slathered the hair down, yeah.
Giving you a lifelong aversion to greasy hair.
Giving me a lifelong aversion to greasy hair, yeah. Brill Cream I used to hate. But there were heaps of jingles for things like that. I remember all the car ads, and I was a real rev head even in those days, even though the Vanguard Spacemaster was an embarrassment. But we eventually got a Ford Custom line, and oh my Lord, did I think we were hot in that.
In the 50s, of course, one of the big things was the launch of Sputnik and the satellite, and then Laika the dog. That really troubled you, and I think it troubled a lot of kids in those days, didn't it?
Yeah, there was in our front yard, we had the wooden paling fence. This is in Mount Gambier in Acacia Street. And this particular night, Dad got us out on the fence to watch Sputnik go over. And I was absolutely amazed, you know. It just looked like a star, but it was moving and all the others were sitting still. Then we heard the story about the dog, and of course, you ask embarrassing questions like, when's that spaceship coming back? And Dad said, it's not. What about the dog? And I said, how much food has it got? And he said, oh, enough for a couple of days. Now, what happens then? And he said, oh, we'll just go to sleep. And then I can remember the nuns at school telling us, well, see, that's the communists for you. And I thought, hell, if they do that to a dog, what would they do? What would they do to a Catholic kid if they got hands on?
Tell me about you and your cousin Robin and your adventures in what was called tag painting, please.
Robin was my... Even though I had heaps of brothers, obviously, Robin was my best mate. He lived in Mount Gambier as well. He was about a year older than me, not quite. And we used to hang around together. I'd sleep at his place, and he was virtually like an 11th kid in our house, and I think he still almost regards my mum as his second mum. But we were a bit on the adventurous side, and Dad had a limestone garage just set away from the house, and on the back you had one of those boards that had all the silhouettes of various tools.
That, oh, the saw, and the
hammers
drill,
and drills and what have you. Everything that was supposed to be hanging there. Mind you, there were no tools, just the silhouettes, because we'd lost them all. But he used to also stack up leftover paint, and they'd, you know, whitewash the house and do all this sort of stuff, and all the paints would be there. Robin and I prized open one of these tins of paint. And I don't know why we decided to do this. We've discussed it in more recent years. Why do you think we did that? And we decided to paint our tags. Now, tag was the word my mum used for a penis because the tag would tell whether you were a boy or a girl. And that seemed to make pretty good sense. So both of us dropped our dacks and painted our tags.
What colour, may I ask? White.
White, and high gloss. And we must have gone across the road without our trousers on, because across the road there was a vacant block and it had what we used to call dandelions. They were the capeweed flowers, you know, the yellow things. And we plucked one each and stuck it down the end. It was pretty effective, apparently. Got bored with it, so obviously put the dacks back on. But bath time that night, coming back home, the mum used to sort of queue us all up for the bath, and it was the youngest kids first, and then she'd keep topping the water up, you know, with the warmer water. I think all the younger kids were piddling in there, quite frankly. We didn't think about it. When it was Robin and my turn, she said, get your clothes off, boys, and we dropped the clothes. And I can still actually picture her face. And she was totally incoherent, and she rang the doctor. It was a guy called, and his name was literally Guy Robertson, who was the GP in Mount Gambier. I think he hated my family because of all sorts of, you know, you have to go and get vaccinations, and we'd hide under the table and do all sorts of things. Anyway, he suggested TERPs, and it worked because we never did it again. He was a cruel wretch.
There's nothing in any motherhood manual that prepares a mother for the sight of two small boys with glossy white penises with dandelions sticking out of them, is there? There's nothing in that, is there?
And they had wilted as well. And they were very difficult to remove.
Your dad was involved in sawmilling, wasn't he, to begin with? And then you moved from Mount Gambier to the town of Nangwari, still in South Australia. Now, this was a big migrants' town, wasn't it?
It was, because just being after the Second World War, it was set up as a timber milling town, and it turns out a lot of the Italian prisoners of war who were in that part of the world, they were being kept in camps down around Mount Gambier, migrated back to Australia after the war. And you heard stories about them at the prisoner of war camps and the home guard, the young blokes and the old blokes, looking after these prisoners of war who were working in the forests. The prisoners used to carry their 303s for them because they were too heavy. So I don't think they were much of a threat, really. But at Nangwari, when we moved there, I think there was my family, one other family off a farm, and some cousins who were the only kids who had English as a first language. The rest of them were Italian, Croatian, Germans, Poles, from all over the place. And the school that I went to, which was called Our Lady of the Pines, was run by Brown Josephite nuns, Mary McKillop's mob.
The Brown Joeys.
The Brown Joeys. And they had two rooms with a partition, a folding partition between grades 1, 2, 3 and 4 in one room and 5, 6 and 7 in the other. And one nun taught all of those classes, which was just phenomenal. And when you consider that I think in grade 7 there were 11 of us in grade 7, and I think there were about 4 scholarships out of the 11 getting through to secondary school. So they were doing something right. They were fantastic.
This was Sister Andrina from the Brown Joeys. You adored her. Why?
Loved her.
Why?
Loved her a bit because she wasn't boring. She was a fantastic drop punt.
She coached the footy team.
She coached the footy side. And bear in mind, these in the days when they were the full drag, you know, it wasn't just half there. This was the whole thing.
Full metal Whipple,
and, yeah, in other words. Full metal Whipple. And she'd hitch the bottom of her cassock up into the thick black stockings, and she was a mean kick, I tell you. She was very good, but she also, boring stuff, I used to think, like, poetry was, oh, God, we'd have to go through poetry again, but she was so good about it, and she'd tell you, she'd combine it with a geography lesson, like Banjo Paterson I used to love, and she'd do, like, The Man from Snowy River. And she'd have the maps of where Snowy River was, what the country was like, what the people there were like, and then she'd tell the story in the poem. Another one was Hilaire Belloc's Tarantella, which is like a dance in the high mountains in the border of Spain. And she'd tell that story as she would do the dancing on the stage, like a girl doing a tarantella in one of these sleazy bars, like, do you remember an inn, Miranda? Do you remember an inn? And she'd click her fingers and spin around and just transfixed. And I loved it.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
If you've just joined us, you're hearing a conversation with ABC broadcaster Ian Cameron, recorded in front of a live audience. You had your nemesis in Nangwari, a kid called Rue Yates.
David Yates, yeah, Rue Yates.
A violent kid, by your account.
A horrible, horrible piece of work. You know, I've heard since that he has read my book and he said, I actually always quite liked that kid. And I thought, well, he had a funny way of showing it, bashing me up at every turn. But
how were you revenged on him?
Oh, it was so... this is cunning, you see. Cunning will always outdo brute force every time. Because if you had something that he wanted, he would just come up and say, I'll have that. I had a packet of Juicy Fruits chewing gum, and it's no good if people don't know what they're up to. So during lunch playtime, I let the kids know what I was up to. I'd gone down behind the toilets where the bikes were stored, laid the Juicy Fruits out on the fence and weed on them, and then left them in the sun to dry, put them back in the packet, took them back into the classroom. Just before lunch, as the bell had gone and we were getting up, I very ostentatiously took out the Juicy Fruits. Of course, Rue saw it and said, I'll have those. Stuffed them all in at once, and all the kids are falling around. And he's going, what? What? And they told him what had happened. Oh, I could hardly stand up for a week, but it was worth it.
Tell me how you tried to kill your father.
We, at that stage, had moved from Nangwari, and Dad had bought a dairy farm at a place called Mount McIntyre, which is between a place called Kalangadoo and Millicent. And at that stage, he'd bought a Volkswagen microbus because we almost had the full complement of kids and it had three rows of seats. And every Sunday, we'd get all slickered up with the Brill Cream and everything else to go into Mass in Millicent. And we would always misbehave because in those days, it was the full Latin thing that went on and you get bored, rigid, and you had no idea what was going on and all the rest. But mind you, I digress here, I was an altar boy. And when the Mass was translated to English, I thought, what? Is this all that we've been saying all these years? I thought it was something really profound and interesting, and it's just the same stuff repeated over and over and over. Anyway, he would read the Riot Act before we got to Mass, and he'd say, you play up today, I tell you something, I'm going to knock you. Always phrases like, I'm going to knock you into the middle of next week. You are going to think all your Sundays have come at once. Or the electric kettle cord. And that's when he really wasn't mucking around. So we'd think, yeah, we'll have to behave today. And he'd have the boys lined up in the pew in front and the younger kids behind. So mum would always have a baby and a toddler and all that sort of stuff. And invariably, you'd get the giggles, usually at the most sacred part of the mass. And Dad, in a very sacred way, would be going bash across the room, the back of our heads. And we'd know that we are going to be so in for it when we get home. But that makes it worse. And you're laughing and laughing and laughing. And in the finish, he'd just grab us and just drag us out of the church and fling us in the car. And he said, right, oh, you don't know what you're going to get when we get home. Then, of course, we'd start panicking about it all. And we get home. Peter in, Charles Malcolm, stay in the car, rest inside. So Dad waits for everyone to go inside, gets his belt off, and starting with the youngest, Malcolm was always a bit spoilt, so he just got a tap. Then Charles get maybe two taps. I'd get half a dozen, Peter would get half a dozen because we're the older ones. Anyway, I'd gone back inside and I said, Pete, we can't go on like this. We've got to get rid of him. And Peter at that stage had just started secondary school and he was doing physics. And I said, we've got to get rid of him in such a way that no one knows we did it. And we knew that later that day we were going across to my Uncle Mac and Auntie Maureen's place for lunch, which we often did on Sundays, or they'd come to our place. They were Presbyterian, so they'd fit in their services at some other place. And anyway, Peter had worked out that if we connected the electricity out of the shearer's quarters to the calf fence, there was already an electric fence into the calf paddock, and we wound the calf fence around the metal bumper bar of the microbus, it would conduct electricity up through the vehicle and kill him when he came out to open the car. We had to work it out so that we didn't kill everyone else as well. So what we'd done was push the microbus up close to the fence, put the wire around it, he did the necessary work in the shearer's quarters, and then we set the hose going so that all the ground was really wet. So that Peter worked out, this way you get a proper charge, and it meant that all the kids wouldn't have to get into the bus first because they'd make a mess. So we'd say, oh, we'll wait in the driveway while you get the microbus out, Dad. So out we come, we're all perched up in the driveway. He walked across to it, touched the door. It was spectacular. There was this blue flash, but it came out of the shearer's quarters and bang! And Dad just went backwards into the water. He's going, God, God, and standing up, and we panic because he's not dead. And I said to Peter, you better get that wire off the front of the car. So he's around the front and, oh, what's wrong, Dad? What's wrong? And he got it off the front of the car. And Dad said it must have... He didn't realise till he read my book that it was, in fact, an attempt on his life.
It's amazing your father's still alive today, really. You came very, very close to breaking his spirit entirely, and it all began with you pinching a length of fuse.
Yeah. A guy across the road from us, I think he was a little bit strange. He used to love blowing up red gum stumps, and I think he had a thing about crackers, you know, but he was an older man. It wasn't like kids with crackers. We had saved up, or Robin had saved up, his eightpenny bungers because he had, you know, great big, those big fat ones that you could blow up letterboxes with. And I think we had a bundle of about six or eight of them. But we needed the fuse that would burn underground so you couldn't see it happening. So we knew this guy was blowing up stumps with gelignite. We even handled a bit of gelignite thinking, wonder if we'll use that instead. We thought, no, it's probably going too far. So we got a piece of fuse. We even experimented and timed it to see how long it took. And so we knew it was going to work. And we connected it up to these crackers. We buried them in a race between a cypress hedge and the bull paddock, which led down to the dairy. Dad was milking between 80 and 100 cows at any given time. So it was quite a big herd.
So this is a lane. It under a lane.
You had to wait
where the cows went through.
When they were going to be, you know, Bin Laden would have been proud of this because they were funneled right in there. And we were up in the cypress hedge. We lit it at the given time. The cows are coming in. Robin had the binoculars watching Dad come up the paddock. The dogs were sort of rounding up the cows. We thought it hadn't worked because the fuse had taken longer. Mind you, we were burning underground, so we thought, nah, this is not going to work. But then it did, and it didn't go off just like one big bang. It was like bang, 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 as all the various crackers went off. It was spectacular.
Well, earth rose into the air, did
it? Yeah, because it was all dusty, because there was no grass in this laneway. There was earth, cloud of earth in the air. The cows knocked down the hedge into the orchard. They knocked down the hedge into the bull paddock. Thus, we had some unfortunate arrivals a little bit later when it shouldn't have been. And they went back the direction of Dad and the dogs. And there was milk going everywhere.
But it was milking time. Cows and milk everywhere.
Darkie, which was a bit of a nutty dog anyway at the best of times, was flattened out like a placati rug. And there was no whites, there was no colour in his eyes. The whites of his eyes had rolled up in his head. But the old man was on his knees, and this is when I started to get an inkling that we could be in a bit of bother. Dad was clutching at the ground, and it was sandy, and he's just letting it trickle through his fingers. And he's screaming out at the top of his voice, "Those effing kids, those effing, if I don't kill those effing kids, I'll go hopping to effing hell in an effing handcart." And the house was right alongside. Mum is sprinting out the back door. She's heard the bang and the bellowing and all this carry on. And all she can yell out is, "Duncan, not the F word." I wanted to call the book Duncan, not the F word. They didn't reckon it would go very well on a school curriculum.
Ian, you wrote how much you'd enjoyed your time being taught by Sister Andrina at Our Lady of the Pines, and then you were sent to boarding school with Maris Brothers in Mount Gambier, and that was a different kettle of fish to the Brown Joeys. You hated it there pretty much from day one, didn't you?
Yeah, despised it. My brother Peter had already gone there for a couple of years. He liked it. And enjoyed the school, because we're on a farm, and in wintertime you get floods, and the only way to get into town was try to get to Kalangadoo and then on the train in from Adelaide. So it was pretty much easier to board, but I just despised it. Coming from a big, warm family into a dormitory situation where there are like 90 kids and three rows of old army beds, I just didn't like it for a start. But within a week or so of starting there was this creep who was the headmaster at the time, Brother Bertinus, used to call you into his office, and he used to spook the living daylights out of me, checking to see that you were developing properly, and don't tell anyone about this because your mother and father would be very cross because I'm only doing my job and my duty and all the rest of it. So I just hated it, despised it. He, on one occasion, attempted to rape me, but wasn't highly successful, but enough for me to be bleeding. And I can remember hiding my pyjama pants in the sludge that they used to light the boilers with so that you'd heat the water up for the dormitories. And I ended up getting caned for losing my pyjama pants. How do you tell anyone why you had to bury your pyjama pants? You know, and I didn't know what the hell was going on. And like I've learnt so many times since, and I've done work with some other groups about this, you do the typical kid thing. It's something I've done. It's my fault. I did something to bring this on to me. And as Mum and Dad were very, very, you know, committed Christians and hardcore Catholics, a man of God wouldn't do a thing like that. You know, even if you attempted to say something, you can't talk about the brothers like that. You know, because there were some cruel buggers there. You know, there was a bloke called Brother Raymond, who was not cruel sexually, but he was just a sadist. He used to pick on usually the weakest kid, give him a hard time. There was a kid, we used to call him Fiji, because he was from Fiji, red-headed fat kid. And he wasn't bright, but this creature used to pick on him all the time and call him fat boy. Can you imagine if someone did it these days? It just wouldn't happen. We're talking the early 60s. And of course, you can't help yourself. I said one day, "Not half as fat as you are, fat guts." And what did you say, Cameron? Do you want to come out in the front of the class and just repeat what you said? And of course, being the idiot that I am, I went out and said, "He's probably not even as third as fat as you are." And that was the end of the penny section. He just lost his temper and belted the living daylights out of me. But
with what, a cane or his fists or what?
No, a cane. You know, they had canes in those days. But that wasn't the worst of it. I used to get caned a lot because I was a bad kid. When I say bad, disruptive. Now, I presume it stems from, you know, you wouldn't sleep properly at night because you didn't know when you're going to come and get tapped on the shoulder. There was another kid it was happening to as well, and I knew, but we didn't really talk about it.
You probably didn't have the language for it.
No. Well, you didn't know. I was still kind of calling my penis a tag at that stage. So, so yeah, there wasn't the language to describe it. My parents always thought there was something weird because of my hatred of school, but I was also a slightly effeminate kid, and because I was the second eldest and there were four boys, I used to be the one the boys had helped Dad milk the cows. I used to help Mum in the kitchen and do cleaning and with the babies. So I did girly things and, you know, used to often get called sissy by others. So I don't know whether that was, you know, entree for this character to pick on me because he thought, oh, here's an effeminate kid, because the other kid who was copying it was effeminate too.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio. Conversations broadcast, podcast and online.
You're listening to a conversation I recorded with ABC broadcaster Ian Cameron. It's an absolute outrage what happened to you. There were other kids. You mentioned one.
There were many more. I didn't realise until after I wrote the book. I only referred to it obliquely, as you say, in two pages, in a chapter called Bastards in Black. And I started getting letters from people who'd experienced, you know, treatment at the hands of this guy here at Northam in Western Australia, Wangaratta in Victoria. A woman from Melbourne wrote to me, her first husband killed himself, leaving her with three young boys. She'd since been remarried, so didn't want any publicity brought to the case, but said it was because of this guy.
You said then that you figured, like many people in this situation, so any kid who's had the bad thing happen, that must be my fault somehow. Did you conclude you were a bad person then?
Yep. Bad, dumb, because my grades at school, from being a bright kid up until high school, just went through the ground. I left school at 14. I was really invited to leave school at 14. There's no point in wasting any more money on me. I was failed twice, and you know, you think that would set some alarm bells ringing. How come this kid, who was so good at primary or, you know, a bit above average, suddenly goes to the bottom of the class? And it was all because of this traumatic experience. And then, of course, you think, my life's going to be nothing. I had a heap of useless jobs, which I'm glad I did now because it was a great learning experience working in the cheese factory and a shearing team here in Western Australia, in a fishing team, doing all sorts of menial jobs before I got into radio, which is the most menial of all.
Did you reflect on that grotesque abuse you'd suffered a lot, or did you just push it way, way down?
Pretty much pushed it way, way down, and every time I'd start thinking about it, which I have to say is pretty much every day of my life, no, don't think about that, put it away. The only person who ever knew was Wendy, my wife, or the woman who was to become my wife. Before we got married, I said, I've got some issues and some bad stuff has happened to me. And I told her, but said I didn't want anyone else to be talking about it, and just left it at that for years and years and years.
You said you took on a whole lot of menial jobs. You worked as a roustabout and as a kind of a fisherman for a while as well.
Yep.
And you began to experience depressive episodes where you sort of sit and think. And you, the nature of that work means, I suppose, you sit for quite a long while just doing work with your hands, and then your thoughts can then run on, can't they?
Yeah, and I thought, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? You know, if I had to do this, the jobs I was doing, I think I'd go mad, because when I was a roustabout in the cheering team down around Cranbrook and Katanning, lovely blokes I was working with, but, you know, I was only a kid, 16, 17, and they'd be on the piss after cutout every night, and I didn't drink at all. And I used to find it quite amusing, and I didn't take umbrage at it at all. That's to get the poofter to recite some poems. So I was the poofter who recited the poems. To their credit, they all loved it and applauded, depending upon how much they'd drunk. But I used to worry about, I didn't want to do that for the rest of my life. I didn't particularly like the way their lives had panned out.
You went to Albany for a while when the family moved to WA, and then you went into radio. But you hadn't finished secondary school, let alone having a tertiary, any kind of tertiary education. There's no family connection with the local radio station, 6VA in no. Albany. How did you get a job there?
I used to listen to them because they used to play teen time requests, as they called it, in the afternoon.
Teen time requests.
And there was a manager there, a guy called Ted Furlong. He was larger than life character, big booming voice. And I walked in there during my lunchtime one day. I was 18, so you'd only do this if you were 18. And I said, could I speak to the manager? And he came out, and he said, yes. And I said, I'd like a job. He said, what has? And I said, it was an announcer. And he roared with laughter. And he said, what makes you think you could be an announcer? And I said, because I'm better than the ones you've got. And he laughed and laughed and laughed. And he said, look, you can come in and sit in on Saturday nights just to see if you like the look of, you know, how it goes. Rick Rogers was the guy who was doing Saturday nights. And I did it for about a month, just watching what he did. And he was breeding show dogs, and one of the bitches had gone into labour, and he had to leave early. And I said, look, I can do it. I'll do the last hour of the show. And he said, are you sure? And I said, yeah, yeah. I know how to shut the transmitter down, and she had to do all that stuff in those days. So off he went, and I did the last bit of the show, and I just finished at midnight, and we shut the station down, the phone rang, and it was Ted Furlong, the manager. What do you think you're doing, son? And I said, oh, Mr. Rogers had to go because he had some problems at home. Right, come in and see me on Monday. So I thought, oh, well, this is where I get the sack. And he gave me a job. And the rest, as they say, is history.
You got married and eventually got a job at the ABC here in Perth. The audition for the ABC in those days was an interesting thing. Another friend of mine joined the ABC around about the same time, and he said, you were quizzed endlessly on your general knowledge. You had to sort of explain the Suez Crisis and things like
that. Yes, you were supposed to have a couple of languages. You had to have a tertiary education to get a job as an announcer. And they said to me, well, which university did I attend? And I said, I went to the University of South Australia. And I thought, shit, I hope there was a university.
There wasn't then, no.
No. But no one checked. No one checked. The general knowledge stuff had always been pretty good on anyway, so I sailed through with that okay. It took about 3 months after I initially applied, but I got a job there, and that was a great training ground because it was in the days when the ABC forced you to do everything. You had to do television news, you had to do classical music, you had to do popular music, read news bulletins on radio, cross to sporting broadcasts. Occasionally, I got my break on reading television news because someone was too plastered to go on. So they said, Cameron, borrow a jacket, get on.
Tell me about the incident where you were asked to read some late-breaking news which got you into terrible trouble.
It was nearly shocking. Sacked. It was nearly sacked. It was a Saturday evening bulletin, and you'd go to the newsroom beforehand and go through all the scripts, and they were like typed up on the various sheets in fairly bold type so you could follow it down quite easily. And if there was something came in late as a must-read, it would be yellow, like on a yellow sheet, and they just slip it up onto the desk and you then put it down to the back so you'd know that when you get the wind-up, you go to the must-read. I had not read the must-read, obviously, because it came in late. And it was a guy who'd been out shooting goats, mountain goats, feral goats. And there was one up on a ledge some distance above him. He shot this goat and it fell on him. And injured him rather badly, but, you know, nothing life-threatening. And they managed to get him down further from the mountain to where they could get an ambulance to him. And they managed to back the ambulance up, and he's laying on the ground, and they ran over him. And, and at this stage, I wasn't laughing still, but I started to see some humour in it. And as they were going to the hospital, going across the bridge, hit the cow and it rolled over. And then I'm listing the injuries. He had a broken collarbone, 2 broken legs, 4 broken ribs. But at this stage, I couldn't speak anymore.
Now, Wendy was watching this at home, wasn't she?
Yeah, we were living up in Gooseberry Hill at the time. We had some freeloaders coming around for dinner that Saturday night. And she'd put the kids to bed, and she was walking back out through the family room, and she said, there's the screen full of my face, I'm crying, and saying, I'm sorry. She said, nothing else is coming out. I'm just going, I'm sorry. And he's having a breakdown. She's thinking, well, why aren't they getting him off? And in the finish, I managed just to gasp out, George Manning with the weather. And they went across to the weather screen in the days when they had the weather screen, and there it was with all the synoptic charts and everything else. No George to be seen. And then the weather pointer came up and it was from below and he's just going, whack, whack. And all you can hear is, whack. And it went, and I'm at this stage, of course, I'm panicking, thinking, well, this is it. This is it. And we went to an interlude, and it was King's Park and All the Flowers, and that was the end of the news bulletin. And at this stage, I knew this was the end. Got out to the makeup room. The phone was already ringing. Duty supervisor, David Guy, said, Mr. Chisholm, that's the general manager, wants to see you in his office Monday morning, first thing. And going, oh, God. Graham Chisholm had been in the Second World War. He'd been through Changi, and he looked like he was still there. He was so gaunt.
And now he was going through Cameron.
He was going through Cameron. I think he found it more of a trial, frankly. Anyway, I got there early outside his office and I'm sitting there. He walked past, ignored me. I was dressed up in a suit and sweating like you wouldn't believe. And after a while, his secretary came out and said, Mr. Chisholm, we'll see you now. So I went in. I'm just standing there at his desk for ages. He's just writing something. He said, sit down. So I sat down and he's still going on writing. And he took his glasses off and he's rubbing his forehead and he says, what have you got to say for yourself about Saturday night? I said, I'm so ashamed. If you give me a second chance, I promise it will never happen again. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I'm grovelling and begging. I've got three young kids, you know, I've got to feed them. And he said, it was probably one of the most unprofessional things I've ever seen in my life. And funny though. And I'm going, oh, thank you. And he's saying, not that funny. And he said, Mr. Manning is in more bother than you. He should have known better. So I said, thank you. But I managed to escape to live another day.
You had kids, as you say, not much money around at the time, and then you were brought in for your assessment. Yeah. Pretty much sacked as a presenter. I think ABC, why were you found to be wanting?
They told me that I didn't have a future as a broadcaster. They did offer me a manager's job, which says something about management, I think. And they said, we're not going to do it immediately. It'll probably take us about 3 months to get all of this finalised and all the rest of it. I was just stressed about it. In the meantime, one of our presenters had left and I filled in on the breakfast show because they had no one else. I did that for about 3 months and the ratings came out and I thought they were winding me up. They were number one. No, the ABC doesn't go to number one. And we were.
Why do you think you got there? Why do you think you turned it around in what a couple of three
I think
months?
I think it was just a bit different to what everyone else was doing. And
in
I
what
was,
way? What
I was a
doing?
Bit naughtier than some of them. Getting suspended and getting a bit of publicity for it from time to time. That always helped. And the listeners were always really loyal because they would ring the ABC and whinge when they would discipline me for something. We were doing limericks and I got suspended for a fortnight for the limerick and I thought it was really good. Mary had a little lamb. She kept it in a bucket. And every time she let it out, the farmer's dog would chase it around the yard. 2 weeks for that. But also at the same time, they had a competition, and I've always remembered this. They had a competition, they had to make up a little limerick about me. And I've always remembered a breakfast announcer named Ian, of hirsute and terrible mien, although he's quite lofty, he's really a softy. In fact, we suspect he's a queen. There's always been a great connection with the audience, and I think that's what's worked over the years.
That obviously was a moment I think anyone would relish, a personal triumph that was. Nonetheless, you were still suffering from depressive spells. Tell me how you'd feel during those spells.
They used to call it manic depression in the time, and it's now called a bipolar disorder, which they know a lot more about. I'd get really high highs and really low lows. And Wendy knew about them because she was the one who, when you're at work, as a psychiatrist has said to me in more recent times, I've got the perfect job for a person who has a bipolar disorder because you can funnel all your up, up, up stuff on air. And I've never had a problem doing that. Even if I'm having a bad day, as soon as you turn the microphone on, that's your job. No one wants to hear a misery guts. You do it. And by the time you've done it for 3 hours and breakfast, you got yourself in a better frame of mind anyway. And in the old days, you know, when I say in the old days, 19, 20 years ago when I first got some help, the drugs were hopeless. That they'd give you stuff called Elavil that I was taking just calmed you down, and you didn't get up, up, ups, and you didn't get down, down, downs, but all your creativity just goes. You don't feel bad, you don't feel good, you just feel nothing. So I just
You're not you, in other words.
No. And I just said to the doctor, I don't think I'll continue on with this. So I stopped for quite a few years, about 10 years or so. My wife has been fantastic because she knows when it's happening. She was saying, is the dog here? And I was saying, no, but the bloody thing's looking through the window. But once you recognise you've got it, that's half the battle. And you know that you can deal with it, and there are ways of dealing with it. I find there are ways of dealing with it too. Go for a big walk, distract yourself somehow. But now they've got far better drugs, and I don't like the fact that I have to take drugs all the time, but they don't alter your mind or anything like that, and it works out well.
Then you were approached by the Liberal Party of WA to run for the seat of Stirling for federal parliament, and you were elected for two terms from 1993 onwards. I was talking to a senior politician, a former premier, at an event, and she was telling me that one of the hardest things about politics is just constraining yourself from speaking your mind all the time.
Yes.
Because if you do so, there's going to be 10 people who are offended or claim they're offended on behalf of someone else, and on and on it goes. Now, for someone who really made his name and found such pleasure in saying all sorts of improper things, how did you do it?
Good advice, good people around me. The reason I got attracted to politics was because of John Hewson's Fight Back. I read all 700 pages of it. You've never read anything so dull in your life. But it appeared to me the guy had a clue about the change of the taxation system to make it fairer for everyone. If we had the idea of the GST the way he wanted it, we wouldn't have all this nonsense now about carbon taxes and everything else. We'd have buckets of money without people feeling the pain. The people who were going to feel the pain are the ones who spend most money. Anyway, without getting on my high horse, I soon realised that the lunatics in politics are not restricted to any one party. You know, we had plenty of them in the Libs, the Nats, the agrarian socialists, as I like to call them, had plenty in there. The Labor Party had plenty in there. There used to be the saying that you can't buy the Democrats, but you can rent them by the hour. And the Greens, well, you'll find them at the bottom of most cartons. What really surprised me when I got to Canberra was the part that we see, all the carry-on and the fighting and question time, is the theatre and the ratbaggery. Most of it is work. They have all these committees that do the work behind the scenes, and you would be surprised. I would estimate that 70 to 80% of legislation is worked out in a non-acrimonious fashion. You just sweat it through. Someone comes up with a good idea, and they're all mixed parties on these committees. You know, Carmen Lawrence was a fairly controversial premier from Western Australia, and I just happened to get her on one of my committees. I thought, this is going to be interesting. She was brilliant, studious, concerned, crossed the T's, dotted the I's, diligent. We worked together fantastically, and that was the case with most of them. And, you know, to this day, probably my best mate in the federal parliament was a Labor member. And realistically, you don't see all that scruffing and nasty name-calling and everything that goes on in media conferences and all the rest of it.
Yeah, this brings me to my next question to you. I had Lindsay Tanner on, the former finance minister, who's written a book where he's talking about the ever-increasingly poisonous cycle that federal politics has fallen into its relationship with the media. Lindsay Tanner said that it's much easier to give up a satisfying family life for big reform and making big changes to Australia, but it's just not quite enough to give it all up for announceables and sound bites.
Yeah, and I reckon because it does take over your life, for those 6 years that I spent in there, I didn't expect to win the first time around because things were going bad for Hewson. Hewson didn't win, but I did here in Western Australia. And each election after that, we increased our primary vote. But on that third one, we got a really good primary vote, but it was the One Nation preferences that saw me out. And I was quite devastated because I'd tried hard to do a good job. But about a fortnight later, someone said to me, what are you doing next Saturday or something? And I said, I'll have a look in the diary, which was usually the way. And there's usually, no, I can't do that because I've got to go and do this and go and kiss that baby or something. And said nothing. And the Saturday after that, nothing. And I realised I had my life back. And that was really good. And when people say, would you do it again? No, but I'm glad I did.
You published your memoirs, and that reference to Brother Bertinus, who'd assaulted you, really, there's no other way of putting it, abused and assaulted you all those years ago, was published over two pages. Just tell me more about the upshot of that and what that meant for you to write those two pages. Were they the hardest two pages of the book to write?
I actually, possibly. I had written a lot more and more detail, but when I reread the book myself, it came across as jarring because the whole book is happy, apart from that bit. And I thought it would be a lie not to include it because it was such a important thing that happened in my life. It would be a lie not to include it, but I didn't want to make it a real downer, especially as it's right in the guts of the book. So I decided to abbreviate it. People were left in no doubt. You know, the feedback I started getting saying, yeah, we know this guy, he did this, he did that. And it was only after that that I thought, this is the tip of the iceberg, I should pursue this guy further. I didn't get the guts to do it until about 5 years ago and laid a formal complaint with the church.
How did the church deal with that complaint?
I had made appointments to go and see them and then cancelled because I just didn't want to open that can of worms again. But eventually when I did, they were quite professional about it and they said, okay, they'll put me in touch with a Maris brother in Melbourne whose entire job is to deal with complaints of that nature. And that's just the Maris brothers. So this is how large this cancer is inside the Catholic Church and why people are getting frustrated when Rome seems to be not prepared to face it head on. Because if this is just one small order in Australia, we're talking about hundreds of kids who got abused.
Was the brotherhood abused you still in ministry, as they say, when you raised this complaint?
No, he'd gone to a retirement home in... I didn't even know if he was alive, but he was in a retirement home in New South Wales. And being the way the church is structured, they said, oh, well, they can't really do anything because the offence occurred in the Diocese of Adelaide, which was Mount Gambier. It was ministered out of Melbourne. He's now retired in New South Wales. And it was, you know, stonewalling all the way along. And in the finish, I said, no, I'm going to pursue this a bit further because I went... What the catalyst was, the other kid that I knew had been abused, that I went to school with, I tracked him down to a caravan in Casterton in Western Victoria. And I went around knocking on the doors because I'd heard he was living there somewhere. He'd done time in jail and his life had just been a complete mess. I wouldn't have recognised him. He was quite a good-looking little kid when I went to school with him. There was this bloated, fat old man, very sad-looking fellow, and it was him. And I said, have you ever complained to the church? Of, you know, he was destitute. And I said, you've got to get them to at least look after you, do something about this. And he was sort of ambivalent. I think he'd really well and truly dropped his bundle. So when I approached the church, I said, I want you to sort this guy out. You've got to have property somewhere. You can put him in a flat or something because he's in this situation because of what you did. And I then pursued it further myself and they started talking about offering money compensation. I said, it's never been about that. I want an apology. So in the finish, I got an apology and an offer of financial compensation. I said, actually, what I'd really like is enough money to pay my parents back for the money they wasted on my school fees and also a little bit more than that for the amount of misery I've inflicted on other people around the place because of my weirdness, because of what happened. And they scoffed at that and they denied that Bertinus had done anything. His quote was, oh, that's a crock of shit. And that was red rag to a bull. And I said, okay, here we go. So I employed a team of lawyers in Adelaide and it was resolved within about 6 months. They picked up all the legal fees, the lot. And when I saw earlier this year, someone sent me a note saying, Brother Bertinus has just been honoured for 70 years of service. And I said, what? And I looked it up on their website. And one of the lines was, awarded for 70 years of service along with so others, and he's so revered for the numbers of boys' lives he touched. Oh. And I just said, bugger this. So I wrote to Cardinal Pell, to Archbishop Hickey here in Western Australia, and to the head of the Marists in Victoria. Same letter to all of them. and just said, please explain what's going on here. I was told this guy was virtually on the his deathbed. They said he was very frail and not quite with it in the head and all the rest of it. And I read his acceptance speech. And it wasn't a man who was in any... They're protecting him again. So I officially renounced my Catholicism in those letters.
I think it strikes me in the letters, I've seen the copies of the letter, the one you sent and the letters you received in reply, is that the letters you received are legalistic. They are written in sort of rote form, if you like, except for the one you received from the Archbishop of Perth, Barry Hickey, which seemed to be the only letter you received which responded in quite a human human way to what you'd say.
Well, in the letters, you might note, I put a rider on the bottom of it. Any derogatory remarks are not directed at Barry Hickey. I believe him to be a good man. And I still do believe him to be a good man, because his letter, at least, he hand-wrote a note at the bottom, I'm available to talk to you at any time. He was compassionate when he first heard about it. He actually wrote me a handwritten note, nothing on church letterhead, just saying he's just so devastated and this is an appalling thing. What can he do?
I don't suppose that it can be sort of decided one way or another whether the abuse you suffered as a kid are responsible for your bipolar disorder, your mood swings, but I'm sure it couldn't have helped it in any way, even if it had been pre-existing. How do you manage your mood swings now, Ian?
I go on radio. I get on radio at 5 o'clock in the morning, go totally out of control for 2¾ hours, and then come off and go home and cook and just live a normal life. I'm more happy than not. And I'm also married to a gorgeous woman.
On that note, I have to thank you, Ian Cameron. Thank you so much for being my guest in conversation. It's been such a pleasure. Ian Cameron.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.